Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
If saving more and spending less is one of your top goals for 2023, why are you still paying insane amounts of money every month for your phone bill? Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile, you'll get their unlimited plan for 50% off. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Cut your wireless bill to 15 bucks a month at mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Hurry. Offer ends January 15th.
Today, running your small or mid-sized business is challenging to say the least. There is greater pressure to offer a flexible and safe work environment. At HP, we get that. We design our products to support the needs of both the traditional office space and your employees' hybrid environment. We create IT solutions that help run your small or mid-sized business no matter where your employees are. Whether you have 5 employees or 500, HP can help. Call our U.S.-based small business advisor team today at 1-800-608-MYHP or click below.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Paul Moss, and in the early hours of Monday, the 23rd of January, these are our main stories. Police in California hunting the man who killed at least 10 people are reported to have found a body. Germany's foreign minister says Berlin will not object if Poland supplies its tanks to Ukraine. President Biden says the fight for abortion rights in America is not over as activists gather to mark the 50th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade ruling. Also in this podcast,
we have quite good evidence linking the consumption of dairy and particularly milk to better growth, better bone health, things like this.
Scientists discover how ancient humans evolved by learning to drink their milk. As we record this podcast, reports from California say police have found a body in a van which they broke into as they search for the suspect in a mass shooting. At least 10 people were killed at a dance venue in Monterey Park during the Lunar New Year celebrations on Saturday. Residents in the area described how the mood rapidly changed.
It just feels very gloomy. I'm pretty sure all our hearts are heavy, and I'm very happy to see the community come together. However, it's under a bad circumstance.
Today was supposed to be a happy, nice day for everyone to enjoy, but stuff happens, so a lot of people can't enjoy the situation now, and it's not right for the other people not to enjoy.
Earlier, the suspected gunman was identified as a man of Asian appearance. And then on Sunday afternoon, local time, television reports said that he'd been found dead inside the van they'd been looking for. I spoke to Peter Bowes in Monterey Park, who told me the latest.
The police, we've been watching television overhead cameras. We've seen some drone activity above a white van that the authorities believe that the suspect was in. And there is some local reporting that the police have found a body inside of that van believed to be the suspect. Now, I do stress that at this stage that hasn't been confirmed by the authorities, but that's where we are at the situation at the moment. The police had earlier said that they were looking for an Asian man aged between 30 and 50.
There was descriptions of there being a standoff by the van, presumably police rather nervous about going in there with a man potentially with a weapon inside.
Exactly. It looked like quite a tense situation. There was a large presence of heavily armed officers surrounding this vehicle. We saw some drone activity in the air, and I understand that they were actually using the drone to try to get a close look inside the vehicle to see what was happening in there.
As you say, nothing's confirmed. And I'm wondering what the mood's been like there when not only had 10 people been killed, but for a while, it was very clear that the gunman was on the loose.
Yes, clearly people very, very concerned about that. And this is a weekend where this community and many others across this country have been celebrating Lunar New Year. There was a major street festival here on Saturday. It should have been continuing right now and was cancelled in the wake of this shooting. But people were in a very celebratory mood, looking ahead to the next 12 months with optimism, with some excitement. This is a traditional event that, because of COVID, hasn't taken place to its normal full extent over the last few years. So there was a sense of fun in this city, which of course has completely gone away now. And I'm surrounded by people just milling around. I'm very, very close to the scene, and I can see people, onlookers, looking, quite honestly, quite bewildered.
Peter Bowes. For weeks, Germany's been under intense pressure to deliver tanks to Ukraine and to allow other countries who it sold the tanks to send them on to Ukraine themselves. Poland has been particularly forceful on this, and on Sunday, the German Foreign Minister Anna Baerbock said Germany wouldn't stop Poland from sending Ukraine its own Leopard tanks. But there was no such promise from the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz. Rather, he said only that his country and its partners would back the government in Kiev for as long and as comprehensively as needed.
We made the decision a few days ago to deliver infantry fighting vehicles and other weapons to Ukraine, closely coordinated with each other and with our American friends. And we will continue to support Ukraine for as long and as comprehensively as necessary, together as Europeans, to defend our European peace project.
Well, vague words like that won't be enough for Poland, as our correspondent in Warsaw, Adam Easton, explained to me.
What has happened is Poland has sent around 250 of its old Soviet-era tanks to Ukraine, which the Ukrainians are trained for. But it now wants to send these modern and more technically advanced Leopard 2 heavy battle tanks that it got from Germany. And ideally, it wants Germany to send their tanks, their Leopards as well, and any other NATO member who would send it. If Germany won't do that, it wants Germany to give its authorization, which Poland needs, so it can send those 14 Poland's own Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. And it's trying to ramp up the pressure as much as possible. Poland have hinted it might send them anyway, even without Germany's authorization. In Davos last week, the Prime Minister, Mateusz Morawiecki, said, and I quote, "Either we will get their consent or we will do the right thing." And on Friday, a deputy foreign minister said if Germany continued to refuse to give its permission, Poland would take what he called non-standard actions. And when asked directly, he wouldn't rule out sending tanks even without Berlin's permission.
Can you just briefly tell me what would be the consequences if they so flagrantly broke the agreement, the basis on which they were given the tanks in the first place?
Well, this issue is shaping up to be, you know, the most serious rift in the Western coalition. And if Poland did do this, then it would damage NATO unity in the face of Russia's aggression to Ukraine. So that's and also damage Polish-German relations. But there's also practical consequences as well. Without the permission, the German manufacturer provides spare parts and technical support for these tanks. So if Poland didn't have that permission, it would mean that this would become complicated technically.
Adam Easton in Warsaw. When Israel's cabinet met on Sunday, there was an empty chair at the table. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, had sacked one of his leading ministers, but only after the Supreme Court had told him he had to. Aryeh Deri was serving as Deputy Prime Minister, Interior and Health Minister. But he was also someone who'd been convicted of tax evasion and taking bribes, and the court said that meant he shouldn't be in the cabinet. But Mr. Derry's departure may have effects beyond his own political career, as Tom Bateman in Jerusalem told me.
I think the wider political issue here is about Mr. Netanyahu's sense of authority and control over this coalition that he has engineered and been forced to create because he has lost so many old allies on the political right. And we saw this process of him having to engineer an alliance and coalition of far right-wing parties to add to these religious parties that Mr. Deri leads. And I think the problem he's got is that he's had to appoint controversial figures into very senior cabinet positions in order for that coalition to function. Mr. Deri was one of those. He has convictions for corruption, including those for tax offences last year that triggered this whole process of the court saying he couldn't be a minister. It shows you the bind that Mr. Netanyahu is in, arguably the weakest position he's been in, certainly in the last decade of premierships that he has held in Israel. And that's why his political opponents are saying that they don't believe that he is truly in control of this government. It is instead his far right and religious allies who are running things.
I think a lot of outsiders will find this rather difficult to understand. Aryeh Deri is a man who has been convicted of very serious offences. He leads a party which is described as religious. How can they complain about the fact that he's not supposed to be in cabinet? A lot of countries, it would be out of the question for a man like that to be appointed in the first place.
You know, this raises an issue about whether voter bases are prepared to accept the fact that people have convictions. I mean, one of the important things to look at here is Israel's prime minister is on trial for corruption himself, allegations that he denies, and yet he has been re-elected to lead the country. So that's something that just about half the voters in Israel, according to the polls, are really not worried about. And I think that's what you tend to find in this case. I talked about the way in which the voters of the ultra-Orthodox religious parties often follow the teachings of religious elders when it comes to the way they vote. What the politicians say often in these cases is that the courts had some kind of agenda against them. We certainly heard that from Mr. Netanyahu. He calls the whole thing a witch hunt created by the media that he believes that leftist judges have followed. And so the whole thing becomes politicized. In quite a fragmented coalition system of politics, you find voters that are prepared to accept those arguments and keep voting for people, as we have in the case of Aryeh Deri, for example, and Mr. Netanyahu, given these are still allegations, very serious allegations and a very serious trial, that the voters are still prepared to return them to office.
Tom Bateman in Israel. Relatives and friends of dozens of protesters detained in Peru have gathered outside the police headquarters in the country's capital, Lima, to demand information about them. They were taken into custody when police stormed a university campus on Saturday. But this follows 6 weeks of unrest, which began when President Pedro Castillo was ousted. Our America's editor, Leonardo Rocha, reports.
The authorities in Peru said more than 200 people had been taken into custody for illegally trespassing on the San Marcos University's premises in the capital. Dozens of people were injured in clashes in the past few days. More than 40 people have been killed since the left-wing leader was ousted and detained in December. President Dina Boluarte declared a state of emergency a week ago, giving police extra powers to remove roadblocks and tackle protests. But supporters of Mr. Castillo say they will only go away when she releases him and announces new general elections.
Leonardo Rocha. President Joe Biden has said that the fight for abortion rights isn't over. He was speaking as activists across the US on Sunday rallied for the annual Women's March, which has made abortion rights a focus this year. It follows an anti-abortion March for Life on Friday. Both were marking the 50th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade ruling, which made abortion a constitutional right, a decision which was overturned by the Supreme Court last June. The US Vice President Kamala Harris spoke in Florida, which has banned pregnancy terminations, including in cases of rape or incest.
For nearly 50 years, Americans relied on the rights that Roe protected. Today, however, on what would have been its 50th anniversary, we speak of the Roe decision in the past tense. Because last June, the United States Supreme Court took away that constitutional right, a fundamental right, a basic freedom from the people of America, from the women of America.
Vice President Kamala Harris. Our North American editor, Sarah Smith, is in Washington and explained to me first the origins of Sunday's march.
It's the Women's March, which first started in 2017 in response to Donald Trump being elected president. But, of course, now that the constitutional right to have an abortion in America was overturned last year, it has become a pro-choice, pro-abortion movement. And the women and men have been marching through state capitals and big cities and towns right across America to say that they will continue to fight for reproductive rights for women. And even though there is now no guarantee in the Constitution for women to have an abortion, they will fight state by state to try and overturn bans in some states which have completely outlawed abortion and work in other states to try and keep it available.
It's only 2 days since there was the anti-abortion, so-called pro-life march, marches taking place in America. How do they compare?
Well, there was an absolutely huge march here in Washington, D.C. It was the 50th time they have done that, the March for Life. But the first time, of course, since the Roe versus Wade decision was overturned by the Supreme Court. So in many ways, it was a victory rally for the pro-life movement. But they say they can't rest on their laurels. Their work isn't finished yet. What happens now is that they will go into state-by-state battles. It's now 50 fights instead of one. And they want to reach a position where abortion is banned in every single one of the states in America. So they're getting their troops ready on the ground to fight political and legal battles the length and breadth of the country.
I saw that Joseph Biden has said the fight for abortion rights isn't over, but how much can he actually do?
Well, that they will continue to fight to help women access abortions and that they want to make it a right to choose in every single state. But the only way you could do that would be to pass a law through Congress saying that abortion is legal across the entire country. And the Democrats know they simply don't have the votes to do that. They would need 60 votes in the Senate to be able to pass a law like that, and they have only 51. So although the president and the vice president keep repeating that they will never back down in this fight over abortion rights, actually there's not really very much they can do.
Sarah Smith. A family is suing the Guggenheim Museum in New York, demanding it returns a painting worth more than $100 million. The family's Jewish ancestors sold the painting by Picasso at a low price as they were escaping the Nazis in 1938. Andrew Ocheng has this report.
The Woman Ironing was painted in 1904 by Pablo Picasso and was given to the Guggenheim in 1978 by the family of art dealer Justin Tannhauser. He had bought it from the wealthy Jewish couple Karl and Rosie Adler as they were attempting to flee to South America to escape the Holocaust. Mr. Tannhauser is said to have just paid around $1,500 for it. Today, that would be about $32,000. Adler's descendants say it was only the desperation of the war that forced the family to sell the painting at that time and for that price. They also say their ancestors were taken advantage of by the renowned art dealer and that Tannhauser bought other famous works from other desperate Jews at similar throwaway prices, profiting from their misfortune. Now the heirs want the painting back or to be paid the equivalent of its current value of between $100 and $200 million. Neither the museum nor the Tannhauser family has responded to the lawsuit. It's only the latest in a number of cases globally where countries or individuals are demanding for the return of art looted or acquired during wars or occupation.
That report by Andrew Ocheng. Still to come.
It was extraordinary. It was a really incredible experience for me personally, as I knew Stephen's parents for all the years that they were alive, that I've worked for him since 1997.
We speak to the producer of The Fablemans, the new semi-autobiographical film by one of the world's most successful directors, Steven Spielberg. Tulani Maseko was shot dead in front of his family. His killer fired at him through a window before escaping. But it was the timing of the murder which has made his death such a disturbing crime in the southern African country of Eswatini, where he lived. Mr. Maseko was a leading human rights lawyer. He'd regularly criticised King Mswati, who rules as an absolute monarch. And just a few hours before he died, the king had had a few words to say about those who challenged his reign. Nobody should shed any tears or complain, the king said, if mercenaries killed them. What more do we know about the murder? A question I asked our African regional editor, Will Ross.
The news has come partly from opposition people who have confirmed the death, and they're quoting Tulani Maseko's wife as confirming that he was, as you say, shot through a window, unknown gunman. He was at his home with his family. But nothing else is known at the moment. The government has condemned the attack and said they're going to look into it. But, of course, everybody is sort of looking at it very suspiciously, considering what's been happening in Eswatini.
Yeah, what's being said in Eswatini about what the king had said just before this murder, that nobody should cry if people like Mr. Tulani were killed?
The opposition colleagues of Tulani Maseko are seeing this as a political murder. They're seeing it as a murder that took place because of his stance that he's taken, not only as a as a pro-democracy activist and a human rights lawyer. He's also somebody who has taken the king to court. King Mswati changed the name of the country by decree in 2018 from Swaziland to Eswatini, as you said in the introduction. And basically, Thulani Maseko said that was unconstitutional, he didn't follow the right rules, and that was due to happen in court. So the opposition is looking at all this and saying this is clearly a killing, a political killing, because of the stance he took against the king.
These protests against what the king's doing and against the absolute monarchy that they have in Eswatini, are they having any effect at all? Is there any sign that the king is giving any ground?
Well, what's happened is when the crisis has become really deep, the Southern African regional body, SADC, has sort of stepped in and said, look, we'll help resolve this. We need talks. But what the pro-democracy activists say is that whenever SADC has got involved, it's kind of treated the king with kid gloves and probably gone in and said, don't worry, you know, Your Excellency, we'll sort these people out. But there's never really been a move to instigate talks that are going to lead to any changes. Clearly, the king is resisting any kind of pressure to see that there are changes in the country, because that would be the end of the road for him in this extraordinary role as the last absolute monarch on the continent.
Will Ross. Here in Britain, the government has defended the appointment of Richard Sharp as the BBC's chairman, following reports that he helped the then Prime Minister Boris Johnson secure a loan guarantee. This allegedly happened just weeks before Mr. Johnson then recommended him for the BBC role. A Cabinet Office spokesman said all the correct processes were followed and that there was additional scrutiny before the appointment by a House of Commons committee. Mr. Johnson's spokesman denied he'd received financial advice from Mr. Sharp and dismissed the opposition Labour Party's suggestion that Mr. Johnson could have breached the MP's code of conduct. More from our political correspondent, Jonathan Blake.
Richard Sharp was appointed chairman of the BBC at the start of 2021 by Boris Johnson and the then Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden. Weeks before that, the Sunday Times reports Mr. Sharp, who has long known Boris Johnson, had helped him get access to a loan of up to £800,000. It's claimed he met Sam Blythe, a wealthy Canadian and distant relative of Mr. Johnson, and later put him in touch with the Cabinet Secretary Simon Case. Richard Sharp has denied any conflict of interest, saying that he simply connected the two men and had no further involvement. Speaking on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, the Foreign Secretary James Cleverly was asked if Mr. Sharp's appointment looked like Boris Johnson doing a favour for a friend.
I know there may be the perception of that going on, but Richard is an incredibly accomplished individual. Had he not had a very, very successful career, giving him a wealth of experience before putting himself forward for BBC chairman, he wouldn't have even been in the looking.
The Sunday Times claims Richard Sharp did not disclose his link to Boris Johnson's loan arrangement to the panel advising the government on his appointment or to the BBC. Labour have asked the Commissioner for Public Appointments to investigate. They've also called for the Parliamentary Standards Commissioner to determine whether Mr. Johnson broke the rules by not declaring the loan. The Shadow Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Pat McFadden, told Radio 4's Broadcasting House there were two clear areas of concern.
You shouldn't have someone who's a candidate to become chairman of the BBC mixed up in the Prime Minister who's appointing that role in that person's personal finances. That's okay. The first thing. And then it's transparency in making clear that all of this was going on.
A spokesman for Boris Johnson said all of his financial arrangements had been properly declared and registered. In a statement, a spokesperson for the Cabinet Office said Richard Sharp was appointed following a rigorous process and all the correct procedures were followed.
Jonathan Blake. The BBC has said it had no role in the recruitment of its chairman and that any questions about the appointment were a matter for the government. Our media editor, Katie Razzle, assesses the impact the story could have on the BBC and its reputation.
Appointed for a four-year term on the recommendation of the Culture Secretary and with a salary of £160,000 a year, the BBC chairman's role is to uphold and protect the independence of the BBC. Richard Sharp is often the public face of the corporation. Only a few days ago, he was making a speech about the financial pressures on the BBC World Service and the importance of impartiality. Now he is accused of helping to alleviate the financial pressures on his old friend Boris Johnson. Crucially, during the application process to be chairman, Mr. Sharp didn't declare a conflict of interest. He insists there was none. The post is a political appointment, but the story is damaging not just to Mr. Sharp personally, but to the BBC more widely. The corporation is making a highly visible effort in a polarised media landscape to put impartiality and transparency at the heart of its attempts to earn people's trust. Whatever the truth of what happened, perceptions matter, particularly with the corporation facing a review of its charter by the government ahead of renewal in 2027.
Katie Razzell. Now, I have a strong memory from childhood of being told I had to drink milk because it would help me grow up big and strong. But this was common advice. And it turns out the advice was even more right than people had realised, because a new study of ancient skeletons has revealed evidence that a spurt in human growth 8,000 years ago was caused by some populations becoming tolerant to lactose, which meant they could digest milk and milk products. One of the researchers involved in the study is Emma Pomeroy from the Department of Archaeology at the University of Cambridge.
We have quite good evidence linking the consumption of dairy, and particularly milk, to better growth, better bone health, things like this. And in the genetics, we see quite clear evidence that a genetic variant that allows us to keep digesting milk throughout our life instead of just when we're young babies was so beneficial that it sort of spreads like wildfire, if you like, around 5,000 years ago, particularly in northern areas of Europe. So while we can't say definitively that we can see this increase in stature in northern parts of Europe, that must be definitely linked to this increase in milk consumption, it's very suggestive that the two coincide in time. And actually, future work will look at this in more detail to try and understand if there is a direct link between this change in the ability to consume milk and improved growth.
Emma Pomeroy from Cambridge University. Steven Spielberg is one of the world's most successful filmmakers, with hits such as Jaws, E.T., Jurassic Park and the Indiana Jones movies. But his latest film is a deeply personal one. Called The Fablemans, it's semi-autobiographical, based on Spielberg's childhood in 1950s and 60s America. The film's already been released to critical acclaim in the US. The producer of The Fablemans, Christy McCosco-Krieger, has worked with Steven Spielberg on many of his films. She told the BBC's Martin Venard what it was like working on this latest one.
Movies are dreams.
It was extraordinary. It was a really incredible experience for me personally, as I knew Steven's parents for all the years that they were alive, that I've worked for him since 1997. And, you know, I know his sisters really well. And so, you know, this was just a story that felt important to tell and really extremely important to get right. The pressure was kind of immense.
And Steven Spielberg has described The Fablemans as $40 million worth of therapy. What did he mean by that?
He sat down with Tony Kushner. They had spoken for years about Steven's family story, but they really got serious in writing it after we made West Side Story, but really after Steven's father passed and his mother had passed away in 2017 at the age of 97. And his father in August of 2020 was 103 when he passed. And so I think that the therapy was Steven working through all of his grief.
Steven Spielberg recently told the Desert Island Discs program on the BBC about how he found making the film.
Probably the biggest struggle I had was not to get emotional. But there were times where it was out of my control.
It shows the breakup of the marriage of the parents of the character Sammy Fableman, who were obviously based on Steven Spielberg's parents. How difficult was that for him?
In this family, it's the scientists versus the artists. Sammy's on my team, takes after me.
Well, I think it was surreal and difficult to go back and relive a painful time in his life. I mean, he really discovered a family that was falling apart. I think that it was extremely important for him to get it right and not sugarcoat it and not pull away from it, but to really, you know, pay attention to the pain and vulnerability that he felt, that his mother felt, that his father felt, and, you know, that their entire family felt.
The character Sammy Fableman, he suffers from a lot of anti-Semitism in the film. Did Steven Spielberg suffer from that as well in his childhood?
Yeah, I think that he definitely had some anti-Semitism. He's grown up with it his whole life, but it definitely made him feel like an outsider.
In the film, we see films made by a teenage Sammy Fableman or a teenage Steven Spielberg, and they look like really professional productions. Did Steven really make such beautiful, well-made films when he was a kid?
What kind of movie are we going to make?
So they actually looked a little bit better than his films did in real life. But some of the tricks and the different things that he used in his films were actually, you know, quite innovative for a kid of his age and in that time period.
You've worked on many of Steven Spielberg's films. What makes a Steven Spielberg film?
You know, it's interesting. I think Steven really puts himself in the audience's shoes and tries to see for himself what an audience would want to see. And he's a populist entertainer.
Now, the film hasn't been a great box office success in North America. Why do you think that is?
It's been hard to get an adult audience back into the movie theater for something that isn't a big, giant, four-quadrant Marvel film.
And it's won a couple of Golden Globes already. Is it going to win Oscars?
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea if it's going to win Oscars.
What was your favorite part?
Christine McCosker-Krieger, producer of Steven Spielberg's The Fablemans, talking to Martin Venard. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Paul Moss. Until next time, goodbye.